mymac.com.
Nico, my cousin! Welcome to America! Come, check out the My Mac podcast with Tim Robinson with me. You will love it!
We've got an interview with Kelly Kagi. He's from Night Ranger, plus Guy Searle, David Cohen, and me, Tim Robertson. My Mac Podcast 189.
The next generation of radio. It's the MyMac.com podcast.
And we're back, and we've got Guy Searle with us this week. Hello, Guy Searle.
Hey, hello. It's been a while.
It's been a while. We tried to get you last week, of course, and having microphone problems, so you didn't have the show.
Yeah, having serious tech problems. I was down at my brother Larry's house, and you know, the two of us, I don't think Larry's been on the podcast other than like some of the Macworld stuff.
Macworld, I think that was the, I don't know. I seem to remember him coming on once, but you may be right. It might have been just at the Macworld.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it was. And it's too bad because he's, and you know, without any false modesty, which I'm sure he would show.
Is a brilliant guy.
Yeah, he's one of the smartest guys I know. That's certainly smarter than me, but that's not really saying much.
And me. And maybe even David Cohen, who's also with us. Hello, David.
Hi there, how are you?
I could be better, I could be worse. One of the things that we're going to talk about this week, obviously, is Night Ranger. We've got them on the show. I did an interview with Night Ranger. I actually recorded that yesterday during the afternoon with Kelly Kagi. He plays drums for Night Ranger, and he does a lot of the singing. In fact, the Sister Christian song, he wrote and actually sang that song. So that's probably the most famous one that everyone seems to know from Night Ranger. And they got a new album coming out. I've got an advanced copy of it, and I'm not going to review the album, but I will say that it's different than what I thought it was going to be. It's a lot harder. I was kind of surprised about that. It seems to me, though, that a lot of the stuff from the 80s is really making a big comeback. Have you noticed that, Guy?
Yeah, I have it, and I think you can pretty much sum that up with Rockstar.
You think so?
Yeah, I think that's these games that they've been coming out with where, you know, you've got the little controller and you're playing along with the song. And let's face it, getting clearance to use a lot of these songs, if they were more recent, would cost, like, big bucks. So,
I don't know. There's a lot of new stuff in those songs, or in those video games. A lot of new stuff.
Well, that's true.
What do you think, David? What's the resurgence in popularity of the 80s music?
I think that, you know, people are always into nostalgia. And, you know, as each generation grows up, then it, you know, it looks back on its teenage years and thinks, you know, that was much better than it is nowadays. So I think these sort of things come in waves.
I think the nostalgia usually kicks in between 25 and 30 years after the fact, and that's right on target for this.
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
And certainly, you know, that when listening to the interview, when you hear that those guitarists in the background, I mean, it brought all sorts of memories back for me. You know, I mean, the thing about music is a real stimulator of memory. You do tend to, when you hear a song, you do remember where you first heard it or you know, certain things associated with it, and you know, it's quite strong, you know.
Yeah, and let's also remember that the people who were like big fans a lot of these bands when they were teenagers are now in like their prime earning years.
Yeah, so, and they can afford to go and buy this stuff.
Exactly. Absolutely. So that doesn't hurt either.
No, it doesn't hurt at all. Of course, there's not really a lot of nostalgia, I don't think anyways, for computer gear, Macintosh computers at least, from the 80s, which you'd have to start at 1984, obviously. But I don't see a real rush on eBay for people buying these old computers. I mean, I could pick up a top-of-the-line computer from, you know, 1989 of a Macintosh for like $20.
some things are very cheap, but some things are crazy expensive. I listen to a Retro Maccast, which is a podcast about a couple of guys who are really into collecting, And some of the they do an eBay find of the week every week, and some of the things sell for thousands of dollars. And there's a guy who bought a 20th anniversary Mac recently for about $2,500.
Yeah, well, see, I want a 20th anniversary Mac, but that's about the only. And for a long time, I wanted the original Macintosh, but I have two of those now. So, but in even that, it was never expensive, and I didn't buy them online. I found them both. One at a garage sale and one at a person's house, and I got them dirt cheap.
I was kicking myself. I was listening to a few back episodes of that particular podcast in the car the other day, and there was one from about 4 weeks ago, and the eBay find of a week was a huge collection of classic Macs, probably about 50, 60 different types, and the guy was just clearing everything out, and because there were so many, he said collection only. And he lives in Staffordshire, which is probably about 30, 40 miles from where I live here in England. And the whole lot sold for like £23, £24, about $50. And I just cried because I would have been all over that. And, you know, I would have kept a few pieces myself and then sold the rest on. And, yeah, it was a shame that I wasn't more up to date with the podcast.
That happens. You snooze, you lose.
Exactly, yeah.
I know Sam had told us last week on the podcast that he was going to try to come on. He's in Barcelona. I did try to get a hold of him via iChat, and he wasn't responding. But it's like 1 in the morning there right now, almost 2 o'clock in the morning as we're recording this.
Yeah, anyone who wants to podcast that late at night is just insane. Wouldn't you agree, David?
Oh, definitely.
It's not quite that late in the UK, though. There's not a whole lot going on. A lot of companies are releasing information on their iPhone apps. That's kind of exciting. But up until the point where we actually get the iPhone 2.0 software and we can start buying or downloading the software, there's really not a lot to talk about. I mean, although personally, and Guy, you're probably going to have to get an iPhone here pretty soon, a lot of this podcast is going to focus on the iPhone market because, let's be clear about this, this is where all the excitement seems to be happening nowadays.
Yeah, I would have to agree with that. I'm really, you know, you guys know what my preference has been and what I've been kind of waiting for from the iPhone, and it doesn't look like it's going to happen anytime soon. But honestly, with everything that's going on, I'm really running out of excuses.
Yeah, I know you want a 32 gig, and I would prefer a 32 gig as well. Here's one thing, though, to keep in mind, and I don't know if you've gone up to AT&T's site, Guy, and looked at their 3G network coverage, but for at least where I am currently, and that may change here soon, there is no 3G coverage. So for me, the only thing that I would get out of a new iPhone, unless I bought like the 16 gig, the only thing I would get out of it is the GPS, and I don't need a GPS on my phone. I've got a Garmin unit.
Right.
So there's absolutely zero reason for me to upgrade my iPhone. I'm perfectly happy with the first generation. It does everything that I want it to do. It's probably going to be faster, snappier, and it's going to have access to all the same applications as the 3G.
Right, because the iPhone 1.0, there's no charge to update the software.
No, none at all. There is if you've got the touch. That's a $20 charge. And yeah, honestly, if I had a touch, I would spend $20 to get the iPhone 2.0 software.
Yeah, I mean, let's face it, if you have a 16 gig or a 32 gig iPod touch, you're already into it for $399 or $499. What the hell's $20?
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I am an early adopter. I spent, you know, $599 for my phone. I did get the $100 rebate, but of course that went back to Apple for Leopard. So didn't really save any money.
Yeah.
And you'll notice that Apple didn't just, you know, send checks out. They sent $100 that you could spend with the Apple Store. So Apple didn't lose any money.
Yeah, they kept it in-house, no doubt.
Yeah. In fact, they got another $39 from me because I got Leopard and it was $139. So, you know, it was $129, so it was $30. But still, I mean, let's be honest, I was going to buy Leopard anyway. So for me, it was just like a $100 coupon.
Right.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I don't really see the need to upgrade my iPhone. Now, of course, as the publisher of MyMac.com, and we do a lot of product reviews surrounding the iPod and the iPhone and all that, it would be nice to have one so I can take a look at the new cases and stuff like that. But to be quite honest, I'm really getting tired of product reviews for cases.
No doubt.
I've got, and I'm not exaggerating, I've got 20 iPhone cases here. And most of them are from Casemate, you know, but I've got 20 cases. I don't need any more cases.
Yeah.
I wouldn't mind, honestly, though, one of those, the naked case that you could see through the whole thing, and it covers a screen as well.
Yeah.
That is a little bit of appealing to me, but I do worry about heat, how it's going to dissipate the heat from the iPhone, because I don't know if you've noticed this, David, the iPhone does get hot with use.
Yeah, certainly. I have noticed that, particularly if you're, if you're running a lot of music or audio through it for a long time, say in the car, then I've noticed it gets quite warm.
Yes. One of the things that we're talking about with the staff for this podcast is doing a little bit more interviews, not necessarily with software developers, which we've done in the past, or big companies like Microsoft or Adobe or even Apple people. We've had, in a roundabout way, we've had Apple employees on the podcast because we had Apple employees taking the Apple quiz at the Expo guy, and we used them in the podcast. So
that was funny.
One of them was actually the product manager from the MacBook Air. I'll say that now because there's some distance between then and now. But we're looking at interviewing musicians and artists and that sort of thing. So what I want to do is I want to send this out to the listeners that if you know somebody out there that's kind of a name, a big name that uses Macs that we have a chance of actually interviewing, go ahead and send me an email at tim@mymac.com, or maybe you're famous yourself.
We'd love to talk to you.
I like to talk to you or the people that you think that would make real good interviewees. Like I said, I did the interview with Kelly Kagi from Night Ranger. We're going to play that here in a second.
Right.
But here's the thing. I'm not the kind of person that's starstruck real easily. So the people that we're looking to interview, we don't want to interview them as fanboys. It's going to be more of a conversationalist type of interview. That's not quite true with a Kelly Kagi interview. I was off my game big time. And to be quite honest, right up to the last minute, within a couple days anyways, I really wasn't prepared for it. And I thought I was interviewing somebody else from another band. So it was just, and it was my fault that the name of the email, the subject matter, was a different person. So when I was emailing back and forth, I thought I was talking about person A, and it wasn't until like 2 days before that, oh no, it's actually person B, which was Kelly Kagi. And I'm not saying anything negative about Kelly. I mean, he was, it was really fun to talk to him. In fact, the best stuff you're not even going to hear on the interview, because that happens quite a bit too, as Guy and David can both attest with other people that we interview.
Or even the stuff that we do once the microphones are off.
Well, when we're not recording anyways.
Yeah.
But I was kind of off my game. I think it came out pretty good. He kind of started the interview a little bit quicker than I thought he was going to. I wasn't quite as prepared, so the beginning of it, I kind of had to go back and fudge a little bit my intro and that kind of thing. But hopefully you guys will enjoy it. I mean, I really enjoyed Night Ranger's music back in the 80s. I thought it was fun.
Well, they've got some great stuff. I mean, you've got Rock in America, which was the name of Secret of My Success. That was the theme for it. Goodbye When You Close Your Eyes, Sister Christian. I mean, these are all just great songs.
Yep. Well, let's go ahead and play that interview, and we'll be back in about, 13 minutes with this show, and we'll talk about our sponsor and the pick of the week with them. Of course,
MacSales.com.
Or otherworldcomputing.com. I think we picked something pretty cool this week. So, but let's listen to Kelly real quick. We'll be right back. In 1980, I was 10 years old, and in 1990, I was 20. That means I went from child to man in the middle of the 1980s and grew up surrounded by what I feel some of the best music ever created. One of the biggest bands of the decade, Night Ranger, had some of the most played songs on the FM dial. When You Close Your Eyes, Don't Tell Me You Love Me, Sentimental Street, The Secret of My Success, and of course the one everybody remembers, Sister Christian, were all tunes that I rocked out to. Night Ranger has a new album, Hole in the Sun, which comes out next month. Singer, songwriter, and drummer for Night Ranger, Kelly Kagi, is also a Big Mac user. Bet you didn't know that. And we were fortunate enough to have Kelly on the show this week. Kelly, thanks for coming on the My Mac Magazine podcast.
Oh, no problem. This is a great opportunity.
Kelly, I have to say, you know, I got a pre-release of Hole in the Sun, your new album, and man, this album really, really rocks. I mean, it's really, really hard.
You know, once you get deeper into it, too, you'll realize that there's still some, you know, There's a lot of old Night Ranger in there. You know, we've just grown over the years, and you know, we have a lot of different you know, musical styles on this thing, kind of, you know. So we got a chance to experiment, not having the record companies, you know, breathing down our throats or you know, trying to micromanage. You know, I've had problems that way, you know, with doing solo records, and you have record companies that are like, you know, micromanaging the whole thing, and it just ends up being really uncreative.
That's always a good thing.
Oh, what about, you know, writing another Sister Christian or whatever? It's like, how do you do that? You know, I mean, really, how do you put yourself back in that situation? But having, you know, lots of time. We gave ourselves lots of time in between touring and all that, so we'd go back to the studio, which was at Jack's house, and we all have studios. I have a Pro Tools system at my house, too, so I could sing backgrounds, and I could do little overdubs and stuff like that, and then just bring the files with me and import them into the master session.
Well, let me ask you, how does the technology of today, has that changed a lot of the way you make music and the way you could control your music?
Well, absolutely. You know, being able to, I mean, you know, like 15 years ago when Pro Tools was first out, it was like, hey, rewind and fast forward is instantaneous, you know? It was like stuff like that. And editing, I mean, it just makes it so fast, you know? I mean, if you want to edit a part out and change the arrangement of a song, it's so easy, of course. It's seamless, you know, and all the crossfades and everything is so perfect. I mean, and it sounds good now. You know, I mean, they're really, you know, kind of honing in on the audio portion of it and the digital to audio, digital to analog converters have gotten so much better. And, you know, plus, you know, you always use the old standard analog outboard gear to get a great sound, and then this thing captures it perfectly, you know.
Does it worry you at all that the quality of the music that people are listening to in, say, MP3 format isn't as the quality isn't there as, say, on an old LP when Night Ranger really came to popularity? LP was the king, and you guys kind of migrated right into cassettes as well. You guys were really at the cutting edge of all the new technologies. Does the MP3 format scare you in that the quality just isn't as good?
Well, when I first started to convert, you know, over to MP3, that was horrible, and you just used it for reference only, you know. But I think that MP3 starting to get better quality. I mean, you can save it as a much bigger file, and it doesn't, you know, erase some of the, you know, the audio, you know, the frequencies and stuff. That's what MP3s do. It seems like it does that, and it takes away some of that. But it's getting better. So, I mean, we still use it for reference, and, you know, we still save everything to waveforms and stuff like that. You know, until they improve it, it's going to be, it'll be like that. You know, we'll be just, you know, using waveforms and stuff like that. But, you know, I mean, it is what it is. You know, people are, you know, I think a lot of times, you know, the average listener in the average ear doesn't hear what we hear in the studio because we spend so much time in front of really good monitors and we know what we're hearing. You know, so when you listen to it with little earbuds and, you know, and iPods, you know, and you listen all the time that way, you don't really notice the quality change.
Yeah. Would you have rather hit it big when you did, or would you have rather hit it big now in that today with computers, people online, they can find music so quickly, they can purchase it instantly. In fact, with the iPhone and the iPod Touch, people are going to be able to buy their music right from this little device that they're holding and listen to it immediately. Do you think that's a better leg up for new artists, or do you think that the way you guys came up, working the club scene, putting years in before you had your first big hit, you really hone your craft? Do you think that was the way to go?
I think you hit on it. That's exactly it. I spent 12 years in the nightclubs before Night Ranger got together. You know, so I learned how to play different styles of music, of course. And then, you know, when I actually got a chance to record, you know, it's like, And I still go at recording this way. It's like, well, go back in there and sing it. Now we got this device that'll, you know, fix it. It's like, no, you don't understand. Once you get out there and you start performing it live, if you can't recreate this stuff, you're going to be in big trouble because you know people will go, God, they didn't sound anything like, what they 15 guitars playing that chorus, you know, all of a sudden, you know, it's like, no, you have to sing that part again. Go in and we'll punch you in just like we used to in audio, you know, in analog. But you had to learn how to perform, you know, the part. So that was the thing, is that you really, you know, had to get better at your craft. You had to, you know, say, oh, yeah, I'm singing this note wrong. Every time I get to this vowel sound, I sing flat. Or so you just learn how to, get better at what you do, singing, playing. Never punched in drums.
Do you enjoy singing more or drumming?
What's that?
Do you enjoy singing more or drumming?
You know, I look forward to the challenge of doing both of them at the same time because it's really, you know, it can be tough, you know. It can be tough, after you're like 4 days into the week, you know.
Well, I bet.
In your fourth show and you're like, oh, man, you know, I'm getting tired here, you know. But, you know, we're a little bit older. You know, we're all about under 30 now. So. But you know what I'm saying? It's like, you know, you start to get tired and you really have to reach in deep down and find that energy to keep going. I just find it challenging to do both, you know. I love
What's the new technology is going to do for you guys going forward, both in your solo career? Because you came out with an album just last year, and with Night Ranger as a whole, where do you guys go with the new technology? How does it help you guys record and get the music out there?
You know what? It helped in the speed of it, you know, because we all live in different states, some of us, you know, and the fact that they can send me a DVD with the files in the session, and then I can work on, maybe backgrounds or some parts. I mean, we try to all be together, you know, when we're recording the main parts, like the basic tracks, of course, we have to do those together, and lead vocals. But when it comes to enhancing and stuff like that, if there's stuff I can do at home, it speeds up that process because I don't have to get on a plane and fly all day, you know, waste a day getting to the studio. I can do it. I can bring it to a studio here in Nashville, or I can do it in my my home studio. So in that way, it speeds up the process.
Do you think that when Napster was the big rage and everybody seemed like they were stealing music and it seemed to me that people didn't realize that what they were doing was wrong. Where did Night Ranger and you in particular come down on that? I mean, obviously you weren't happy that you weren't being paid for that, but do you think that it was more of a case that the people that were downloading from Napster either already owned your cassettes or records, or they weren't going to buy it in the first place?
You know, that's the thing, is that people don't realize that it's the songwriters that are being heard here.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the songwriters don't make a living. There's not going to be any more good songs anymore. It's like people aren't going to want to give their music away if their livelihood goes away. You know, so that's really the thing. I remember, you know, when the Goo Goo Dolls came through here 5 or 6 years ago when they were opening for Bon Jovi, and they said, yeah, you know, our record is, you know, sold a half, you know, like almost a half a million or 600,000 records. He said, but it got downloaded a million times. And it was like, and we didn't get paid for that. And it was like, well, you know, that is just so wrong. It's like, what if I, you know, the guy that sold for me, what if I go over to his place and I take his TV and maybe his car? You know, I mean, it's like, what about that? I'll take your computer. Hey, I need another Mac, you know?
So what's the current Mac that you use?
Right now I have a G5 that I run my Pro Tools on, G5 double processor. You know, I have Pro Tools, of course. I have a laptop, a G4 that I hook up my M-Box to. when I go on the road, I can bring a microphone with me, and I can do start writing a song, or I can do overdubs.
Mm.
I did that on this album. In fact, I took... I was at Jeff Watson's house while they were recording guitars in the other room. I had my M-Box in a bedroom with a good mic pre and a good mic, and I recorded, you know, lead vocals on two of the songs.
It's almost like it's going back to the garage band days where you can record anywhere, but the quality is so much better.
Quality's great. I mean, I was so impressed with it, you know, and doing all the A-B-ing and all the comparing that we've done. You know, it's just really amazing. I am really, you know, they've leaps and bounds in the last 10 years with the, you know, Pro Tools audio and other formats as well.
Well, I know the new Night Ranger album comes out next month in July. I've got an early copy, so I really appreciate that. And I want to tell everyone they should pick it up. It sounds great. It's going to be available on iTunes, I take it?
iTunes, also Amazon. It's on VH1 Classic Records. And VH1 is doing a bang-up job with the promotion on it. We just went to New York and did some interviews, and we did XM and Sirius Radio. Now we're doing your iPod, podcast.
Podcast,
yeah. We're looking forward to it. I mean, it's really exciting to have a new record for the first time in 10 years.
What's the date that it drops?
July 1.
July 1st, the very beginning of July. Well, Kelly, we want to thank you for coming on the podcast this week, and we make sure that we'll pick up that album and promote the heck out of it because it's really good. It's really rocking, and congratulations on a great new album.
Appreciate it. Thanks so much for the opportunity.
And we want to thank Kelly Kagi once again for the interview. That was cool. We're also joined now by Lee Givens. Hello, Lee.
Hey, Tim.
Any news from the AOL front concerning any cool stuff that we're looking at?
Well, let me tell you, the interest now at AOL for iPhone apps has increased dramatically. So,
really?
Every group in the company is looking to do iPhone. So,
text imagine that.
So I'm wondering, yeah. I wonder if they all want to win a 30-inch Apple Cinema display.
Yeah, it's always nice to have that option out there.
Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about our sponsor this week, Otherworld Computing, of course, and or MacSales.com. One of the things I want to talk about, and this is going to go right into an email we got from Jim Felder as well, it's the Newer Tech Mini Stack. This is a pretty cool device. Did you check this out, David?
I did, and I really like these sorts of devices. I know a lot of people have been, and in fact, Guy, I think you're of this mind that there's a gap in Apple's product line in the fact that they don't have a Mac which has space for internal drives and extra cards and connections and that sort of thing, unless you go to the Mac Pro. But to me, I've always thought if you go for a Mac Mini or one of the Mac laptops and you get something like this that gives you all that extra expansion, then you've kind of got a solution that you know is nearly as good as having a mid-range Mac with some space in the case. Love these sorts of devices, and this particular one is very, very well designed.
Aesthetically, it looks very much like a Mac Mini. In fact, the reason it's called Mini Stack,
isn't it?
Yes, and that's why they call it the Mini Stack, because literally you put your Mac Mini on top of this device or vice versa. And you've got a whole lot more space and a lot more ports for your Mac Mini. Of course, it would work with any Mac. You don't have to have a Mac Mini. At that point, it's more of an enclosure. But, I mean, with the Mini Stack version 3, you get two FireWire ports, 800 ports, one FireWire 400 ports, three USB ports, and one eSATA port. That's a lot of ports. I mean, I can't imagine too many people needing more than that.
But there is a slight trade-off as far as, you know, the speed goes between internal storage and a device like this. But considering that with Apple computers you don't have a choice, this really is the best way to go to get not only some more storage for your consumer Mac, but also to add more ports for all the devices that you need.
Well, as we're saying, though, it's a storage solution. What we mean by that is you put a hard drive in this thing.
Right.
Now, you can get the hard drive from Otherworld Computing. So if you got the Mini Stack and, say, 1 terabyte, it'd run you $337. However, if you just want the Mini Stack itself, $109. Bring your own hard drive. So if you've got an old hard drive that will fit in here, it's $109. You're good to go.
Yeah. And, you know, let's face it, you can get a 1 terabyte, you know, naked drive for less than what newer technology is going to charge for the
pre-install.
And the pre-install, you're basically paying for the convenience.
It's pretty cool. Yeah. You know, in today's day and age where everyone has digital photos, everyone has a digital camera, you really need to start backing that up. The mini stack will work just fine with Time Machine, so it's a good solution.
And also it fully integrates with the power supply on the Mac you connected it to, so when you turn that Mac off, then this will turn itself off as well, which is a very nice feature.
With the price of gas and power nowadays, it's definitely a nice feature. So we want to thank Otherworld Computing for sponsoring the podcast, and we will put a direct link to the NewerTech Mini Stack on the MyMac website. Look for show 189 and buy it if you want. Right now, I think they've got like a $30 rebate, so can't beat a $30 rebate. So let's get on to this email that we got from Jim Felder, and he says, well, he remembers us talking about how much, and this was Lee and David, because Guy doesn't have one yet, and our Apple TV, we really like it. He says his wife just bought him one for Father's Day. He got the 160 gig version. He says, I know, what a wife. Yeah, definitely. That's pretty cool. She's really something, and I don't deserve her. We agree. So send her our way.
Exactly.
We all want new Apple TVs, too. And you know, if she's handing them out, Jim, you know, we're ready for one.
Yeah, I think I got a card for Father's Day, I think.
He wanted to know if he can get by with not syncing anything and just streaming everything. He says he could stream everything but photos. He's having trouble streaming photos. Well, let's stop right there. You can't stream photos from your Mac to your Apple TV. You need to sync the photos that you want on the Apple TV to the Apple TV. Or am I incorrect on that? Because I've never tried it. I believe it only shows the pictures that's actually on the Apple TV, correct?
Yeah, sync. You got to sync.
Got to sync them.
Yep.
But you can sync from multiple Macs.
Yes.
So, you know, you don't have to have them all on the same Mac. And they will just synchronize over the wireless connection to the Apple TV.
Currently, what I've got mine doing, and this isn't how I'm going to keep it, but currently what I got going is the last 3 months of pictures on my iPhoto is on the Apple TV. So anytime I update new photos, some of my old ones will drop off. And then I think that's pretty cool. But the problem is I'm really only looking at current photos. What I want to do is go through my iPhoto library, and I started doing this somewhat. I've got it all organized now, but I don't have my photos rated. What I like to do is start rating my photos 1 through 5 and then have only my, you know, 5-star photos sync to my Apple TV. That way it's the best pictures that I have on my computer is also what my Apple TV shows.
Yeah. I think Jim's particular problem was he had some photos in Lightroom and he didn't want to have to put them in iPhoto so that they could then be synced to his Apple TV. Now, what I would recommend you do in those circumstances is remember, of course, that Apple TV will support a Flickr account or a .Mac account for photos.
Yes.
So if you have Lightroom, then what I would do is export the photos you want on the Apple TV to an online account like Flickr or .Mac, and then view them on your Apple TV from there, and they'll just come straight down off the internet to your machine.
It's a good solution.
Yeah.
The other solution that he is asking about is, can he stream everything from the Mac to the Apple TV? So as far as music, as far as video, and the answer is yes. I don't do that.
And caveats.
Except for a few things. Let me put it that way. Or actually, just the opposite. I've got very few things actually on the Apple TV, maybe 20 movies, and most of those are kids shows. Most of my content is actually on my Mac on a couple external FireWire hard drives. I think I've got 2.5 FireWire hard drives full of content. One's a 250, one's a 300, and one's a 160. Actually, I got the 160 thinking it's exactly the same size as the Apple TV. So I'll fill that up, and that will, you know, that's what I'll use to sync. Of course, I filled that up fairly quickly and went, well, I want more stuff on the Apple TV than that. So I took Lee's solution, which is to option drag everything into iTunes, which copies the, not the file, but the, what's the word I'm looking for? The path.
Yep.
So it'll sync it, but it's not actually putting that data on your Apple TV. So when I'm, like, for instance, right now I'm rewatching, because I've seen them all, but I want to get caught up. I'm rewatching the FX series Rescue Me. It's one of my favorite TV shows. I think it's great. And I've got all those sitting on the FireWire 300 drive. I should say it's a FireWire 400 drive, but it's a 300 gigabytes. And when I'm watching it, it's actually on my Mac. Now, of course, I have to have my Mac running and iTunes has to be up for me to do that. But I don't have any hiccups. Now, I am going through the 1 terabyte time capsule, which is a G router. I think if you had anything less than a G router, you may run into some stuttering and some caching problems. Have you had that problem at all, Lee or David?
Yeah, I actually had some problems with my G network for a little while because I have different devices and I was going BG so I could support some older Wi-Fi devices. So I took the next step and I just went up to Time Capsule to go 802.11n and I replaced. I have the first generation MacBook, which didn't had G only, didn't have an N wireless card. So I popped it open, installed a new wireless card for Mac Pro, and now I'm 100% 802.11n and loving it.
Wow. I haven't had any problems with my N router. I mean, everything. Did I say G earlier?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. I meant N. Excuse me.
Oh, good.
With the G router, I was having stutter problems.
Yeah, I couldn't get
N router
streaming.
No, it would for me. But if one of the kids opened up their laptops and started using the same Wi-Fi network,
yeah,
I could tell immediately because everything would go click, click, click. Wait, streaming, caching, and I'm like, ugh, this is just painful.
That's what I was about to say, is that, you know, if the wireless network gets busy, then you can start having problems even if ordinarily it would be all right.
Now, with the N router, I've had, at one time, my wife and both my daughters are all on their laptops browsing the internet through the N router, and I'm still watching stuff on the Apple TV, and it's streaming fine. There was no slowdown at all.
But that's only if you've got equipment that's all using N. If you have any G wireless networks any G wireless devices on the network, then the whole network will slow down to G speed. So it's worth bearing that in mind, particularly if you have older Macs. You know, if you've got an old PowerBook and you open that thing up, then that might only have an 802.11b card in which case your whole network will then slow down to B speed because it can only run as fast as the slowest device in range.
Yeah.
So which that's something else to bear in mind.
But I don't have any problems doing that.
Have any of you guys tried it through a wired Ethernet network?
Well, mine's actually wired through the mains. I'm trialing some power line equipment at the moment. So actually, if I stream from my MacBook in the office, then it's actually going through the mains power cabling to the TV where the Apple TV is and the router is. So and that one, obviously, as you might imagine, that works really well.
Now, I've been hearing a lot about this turning your electricity system into basically a router. Is that working good for you, David?
It is. Every now and again, you kind of have to reset it. I don't know whether that's because the thing is all the power cabling is actually shared with all the other houses in the vicinity.
Right.
So it all goes back to the nearest substation. So they do put encryption into the devices to ensure that if anybody else was running the same type of device, they wouldn't be able to pick up your network traffic. But really, it's very much plug and play. You just plug these two sort of power adapters in at either end, press a button on each of them so they can sync up and encrypt, and then effectively it's like having an Ethernet connection. Not quite as fast as a gigabit Ethernet connection, but you know it's fast, definitely faster than wireless. And yeah, every now and again it kind of drops away, and I have to pull one of them just to reset the connection. But I'm actually been very pleased with it. And the reason I've been looking at it is because I was actually getting somebody trying to attack my network. There was somebody in the area who was they were running some script kiddie programs, and you could tell when they were hitting my network because all of a sudden I just couldn't do anything. And if you went to if I plugged a cable into the back of my AirPort Extreme and had a look at the logs, you could see there was somebody just trying to log into it using different wireless passwords over and over and over again. Uh-huh. And obviously the router was so busy attending to that it wasn't actually able to run the network for me. So, you know, the power line stuff has been a very good solution because it means I don't have to use wireless anywhere near as much as I used to.
Nice.
And that's been good for me.
Now, weren't there some problems with phasing with some of those the older power line units?
I'm using the latest standard, which is the 200 AV standard, which is specifically designed for streaming video. So it's running at the fastest speed. The only thing you have to watch is, yes, it depends on how the power in your house is organized. Yeah.
Right.
So if there's spurs coming out of the fuse box that are completely independent of the main lighting circuit, and sometimes that can happen in older houses that have been extended, then
they won't
jump it, and then you won't be able to see each other. Now, I have a couple of sockets in my house that are actually like that. So when I first put them in there, I just couldn't see anything over them. But you just need to bear that in mind. I mean, with anything that's been built in the last sort of 30, 40 years, you're not going to have that problem because it's all going to be a standard wiring set. So, I mean, the house I'm in is about 110 years old, so the wiring obviously has been added to over time. Yeah, it's been built up over time, and but even with an older wiring, it actually really does the job for me. So I've been very impressed with it.
The other question Jim had was how we're getting the movies onto our computer. And I'll let Lee handle that one. I'm personally using Handbrake, but what are you using and what's your solution for that?
Well, I definitely a big fan of Handbrake. Handbrake and MetaX are my two – it's my workflow now, and it works really nicely. I have a friend at work who rips everything. All he does is he DCSSs the files, and he puts the whole DVD onto just – he just adds a new 1 terabyte hard drive every few months. But I like having my stuff to go, so sometimes if I'm going to a trip or something, I like to be able to just go to iTunes and sync up a couple movies. So I don't mind the lower quality, and I've gotten pretty happy with my latest settings on Handbrake at 1,500 kilobits per second. It looks good enough for me, so I'm pretty happy with it.
That's just exactly the same solution I'm using. I use Handbrake to rip the DVDs to my hard drive, and I'm using the Apple TV settings if it's something that I'm going to watch a few times anyways, and I want the best quality I can get without taking up too much space. But for most of the time, I'm using the iPhone settings, and it looks just fine on my TV.
Yeah.
It looks great. I mean, sometimes if it's a really dark scene, you'll see some choppiness.
You get the blocks in the dark shading areas, yeah.
And I noticed that a few times on the Rescue Me series that I'm watching right now, some really dark passages in the series, and I can't even make out what's going on. I'm like, ugh, but you know what? It's okay. I can live with it.
Yeah.
I've already seen the series, so it's not that big of a deal. I know what's happening.
For my video, I'm using a Turbo.264 encoder, which is the little USB hardware dongle that you plug in, and I've got that on a G4 Mac Mini, and the dongle takes care of actually all the heavy lifting on the video encoding, so I just tend to stream everything through that, and then that drops it straight to iTunes, and then it goes straight to my Apple TV.
I use, like Lee, I use MetaX, and that actually pulls information off of Amazon's website. There's a few times that I have to go in and adjust it for what I want it to say, especially if it's television series. They usually show up as movies, and you want to switch that over to TV setting, that it's a TV show. That way it keeps it all together nice and easily viewable on the Apple TV. You can find what you're looking for much more easier that way. But MetaX is great.
Yeah, and I love that workflow.
Yeah, if you don't want to use MetaX, if you find that's a bit too heavy for you, what you can do is go to Doug's Apple Scripts on the internet, and he has Apple Scripts for iTunes to do pretty much anything you might want to do in iTunes. So nice. If you want to just select a block of movies in your movies folder and change them into TV shows, you can. He has an Apple script that just allows you to select them, and then you select it from the Apple script menu, and it will just do that straight away, yep. And they'll immediately appear as TV shows. So we'll put a link to that in the show notes as well, because that's another way of doing it if you like doing it that way.
Now, here's two other things that I do use. Downloading movies that you don't pay for is illegal. Let's get that out of the way real quick.
Right.
But there are times that I can't find what I'm looking for anywhere. It's not on DVD, so I can't go buy it anywhere. I can't go to the movie store, the video store, and rent it. I can't get it from there. But I want to watch the show. Where do I find it? I use a program called XTorrent. And it's a BitTorrent client, and I'm not sharing any of my stuff. But, I tell you what, it's very rare that I can't find what I'm looking for with XTorrent. I'll give you a prime example because I live in the U.S. I won't get in trouble for this. I was looking for, somebody on Twitter had mentioned the UK Apprentice show. And David Cohen sent me a link for it. But here's the problem. In the U.S., I can't watch this show. It's not on any network here in the U.S. It's not on BBC America. You can't buy the shows online that I found anywhere, at least in the U.S. So I went to XTorrent and found, like, the first 11 episodes or so of the new season, Series 4. Yeah. I haven't watched it yet, but I did download it. I'm going to watch it. Is that against the law? Maybe. But, I want to check this show out.
Just send me the check for your BBC license fee, Tim, and that's then right. I'll make sure that the BBC gets that straight away.
Straight away. But here's the problem. When I download them, they're all AVI files. Now, the Mac will not play AVI files. There's special software that you can go find to play AVI files on your Mac.
Oh, you're talking about Xvid within an AVI wrapper, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
They will not play. So if it's not going to play on the Mac, it's not going to play on the Apple TV. So what do you do? Well, a program that I reviewed a couple months ago, I guess almost a year ago at this point, is called Visual Hub. And with Visual Hub, it will take those AVI files and convert them to pretty much any format you want. And I converted over to, what is the format that I use?
Let me, MP4.
MP4, thank you. Yeah. And with MP4, with H.264 encoding, for the most part, they come out looking great. Or even an MP4. Is that what you said?
Yeah, MP4. You have the option of whether you want to use H.264 or not. H.264 normally looks a little bit better, but takes quite a bit longer to encode. So
With Visual Hub, every one of those apprentices from the UK that I got and I converted, I think it took me about a day to download all of them, which is pretty fast, really, when you think that each one was like, 400 megabytes or more.
Yeah.
And there was 11 of them. And then Visual Hub converted them over to MP4 format with H.264. That took about 3 hours.
Yeah.
On a 2.8 gigahertz iMac.
Yeah, if you've got a faster Mac, then it's going to make a lot of difference.
Yeah, so within about, 26 hours, I had this entire series that I can now watch on my Apple TV. And after I've watched it, I'll throw it away right away because I didn't pay for it.
And I will frequently download stuff off XTorrent for, if it's something that's been on TV here and I've missed it and it's not on my DVR. Well, sometimes even it is, I can record stuff on my DVR, but I can't get the stuff off the DVR to my computer.
There's no
mechanism for actually extracting stuff off the DVR's hard disk. So if I want to take a program I've recorded, but I want to watch it on my iPhone, for instance, then I'll go to XTorrent and pull the thing down again because it's already been broadcast here, so there's nothing wrong.
And you
with
paid for it. I mean, exactly, that's part of your tax.
Yeah. So.
With my cable connection that I have here at home, I get BBC America, so I'm paying for it, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's not like they're showing the BBC America here in the U.S. for free. The BBC is getting money for me to watch their programming.
Yeah, and the BBC, so, BBC has, they have a service called iPlayer, which allows you to see repeats of programs they've shown in the last 7 days. Only works in the U.K., and unfortunately they don't have a Mac client that will download the programs and let you watch them offline. You can only watch them online at the moment as a stream. So again, in those circumstances, going to BitTorrent and getting a BitTorrent copy of the program is sometimes a bit more useful.
Lee, why is it that the media companies are making it so darn difficult for people like us to watch what we want to watch when we want to watch it? It's not that I don't want to pay for it.
Yeah.
It's that I can't pay for it because they're not offering it to me.
Yeah, I think they're, coming from one of the largest media companies in the existence, I kind of understand, where they come from, but they can't repeat the mistakes that the music industry's done.
But
they're making all new mistakes.
Exactly.
Well, that's the thing. They're making even better mistakes, which I think you can't look at your customers as suspects or sue your customers. You got to really think on, how do I get – people are willing to – I mean, Apple's shown, 5 billion songs now downloaded on iTunes. If you do it correctly, people are willing to pay for it. That's 5 billion 99-cent songs. And I heard it was 50,000 videos that are being downloaded per day now. There is a market for this, and there are people who are willing to pay. But if you make it so hard, people, the lowest kind of common denominator always happens.
And I think it's worth thinking about 5 billion songs in. Well, how long has the iTunes store been going now?
7 years now.
Yep. So, that's that's a good proportion of a billion songs every year. How many songs
well,
do
no,
they sell?
Well, no, because on? That's like, not true, because it's they hit their billion about, what, 18 months ago?
Yeah.
It's
so right, it's only getting so, bigger as the time goes.
But even if you look at it over the elapsed time, in the same period, how many songs have they sold on CD?
Will, oh, more than that.
Do you think? 5 billion?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. As much as we like to say that, you know, iTunes is taking over, and it is, don't get me wrong, CD sales are still outpacing digital sales.
But the thing is a number one album, how many units do they have to move to get to a number one album in the Billboard charts now? It's not more than about 100,000.
Right.
Yeah, and it used to be, if you got a platinum disc, that was for a million sales. It hasn't been, bands haven't been getting a platinum disc for a million sales for a long time because they're not shifting that many units.
No, in fact, Bill Palmer was at some event where somebody got a gold record for selling 250,000 songs.
Yeah, and I certainly know that here in the UK, if you want to get a number one single, the number of records you actually have to sell, the number of, however it's counted, because they do include download sales now, the number of units you have to move is nowhere near the size that it used to be. I mean, it's you can see that from the fact that we get a lot of, one-hit wonders and songs that shoot straight into the chart and then shoot straight out again. Just because the overall volume is lower. So, there's something to be said for selling larger volumes of something very cheaply, particularly when it's digital and all the overheads are lower, as opposed to trying to do what the performing arts industries often try to do, which is to protect the price points, to the death. And so every time a new format comes along, they want to charge you the same or more for the new format, rather than saying, well, actually, this time what we're going to do is we're going to sell it for a lot cheaper, and we'll get more sales.
Yeah, that's not going to happen, I don't think. Do you think that's going to happen, Guy?
No, I don't think so at all.
One of the things that I was asking Kelly Kagi about in the interview was how he felt during the height of Napster when everybody was stealing music. And I asked him, I said, where did you come down on that? Was it the fact that it's theft? Or did you kind of look at it like, well, the people who were downloading our songs probably... And what I meant by, Night Ranger songs, it's probably not a bunch of 18-year-olds at the time. It's somebody that probably already owns our albums or our cassettes, or it's somebody that wasn't going to buy it in the first place. And, of course, he came down on, well, that's theft, and, what if I came to your house and stole your Mac? And I totally get where a songwriter like him comes from, that, the stuff's being stolen. He's not seeing a dime for it. And he relates the tale of the Goo Goo Dolls coming to town. And, they had sold so many CDs, but yet their songs have been downloaded a million times. Well, then you get a dime for that. But it's my understanding that artists really never really make their money on music sales. It's always on the concerts. That's where they really make their sales, right?
Well, yeah. Well, that's where the artists make most of their money. But that's not right. The studios are, they're making their money on the back end through sales of the music itself, through publishing rights and, all the rest of that.
What are you going to say, Guy or Lee?
Oh, I was just doing a little math. You know how many songs Apple's selling every day now?
No.
11 million.
Wow. That's amazing.
So they sold a billion songs in the last 90 days. They hit 4 billion, I think it was March 11th.
Yeah.
And 1 billion songs in about 95 days.
So what do you think this is going to do when the iPhone 2.0 comes out and you can, or can you? This is a question that I don't think anybody's answered. Are you going to be able to buy music from the iTunes store?
No.
Through the wireless? It's still going to have to be Wi-Fi.
From what I heard, I think it's Wi-Fi only. And again, it's a licensing reason for that. Because
it's so stupid.
The mobile phone carriers, they want to keep the monopoly on selling music via their networks.
But they're not selling any music on their networks.
No, but they want to keep the option open to do that, and so they don't want to hand it over to Apple. And so,
do you think Apple's going to have to just become kind of a third party carrier themselves eventually?
No, I don't see it's in their interest to do that. The only reason they'd do that is if they thought they could sell more hardware.
Yeah. Do you think that a company like Amazon's going to come out with a storefront in the App Store that will let you download an MP3 directly?
I guess the cell carriers would have the same problem with that they do with Apple.
Well, but, well, on iPhone, well, not necessarily.
Well, yeah, but remember that most of these studios right now are bending over backwards for Amazon or anybody that has some kind of possible solution against the iTunes juggernaut. So they may actually be willing to allow something like that simply to combat iTunes.
But you know what? What I don't get about this, you know, everyone goes, oh, the music companies and the video companies particularly don't want to let Apple, you know, get the steal on them. And it doesn't make any sense to me. Apple is selling billions of units. They are making money off that. Why are they trying to find somebody else? It's like, you know,
because they want to make more.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes, that's Apple's, you know, this is something that the music companies and the movie companies, they're not used to one company being able to dictate to them what it is that they'll sell their product for. They're used to being able to say, okay, well, here's the new record. For the first week, you can sell it at this discount price.
No, that's not true, Guy.
Then it's going to go up to $15.99.
That's not necessarily true. If you look at the way Walmart, over the last 10 years, Walmart has been the biggest music seller for the last 10 years, and there's a reason for that. But Walmart is very much a dictator to their content providers, to their vendors. Not just to the music companies, but to everybody, from the cereal makers to the company that sells the milk. Walmart tells you what they're going to spend and what they're going to sell it for. And if you want to get on Walmart's shelf, which means automatically it's going to sell great, you're going to have to agree to those terms. That's the problem that a lot of people have with Walmart.
And they've been doing that
with the music industry.
What's the digital equivalent to that? iTunes.
iTunes, yeah. Right. But when you say that they're not used to that, they are used to that. And that's been a problem, I think, for a long time. But now here's an upstart that's come up with a digital solution that is doing extremely well. And from all appearances, it's going to continue to do well and do better. It's going to get larger and larger and larger.
Okay, well, think about this. You know, Walmart, even with the power that they had in relationship to music and in relationship to movies, it was still something that they understood. It was, you know, we're going to sell, you know, we're going to send you 5 million copies of, you know, artist A and artist B, and they're going to go on your shelves, and you're going to, you know, people are going to buy them, so on and so forth. Well, the whole thing with iTunes, it's a whole different type of process, and, you know,
I think that was true at one point, but I don't think that's true anymore. I think the music industry, I think they're very savvy, and I think that they know what's going on now. They understand the power of iTunes.
They didn't when as iTunes was kind of coming up. It wasn't until iTunes started.
Well, nobody could have predicted the success of iTunes. When we started this podcast, it wasn't as big as it is now.
I think it was obvious that digital distribution was going to be the wave of the future. Just
absolutely,
the question of who was going to bring that up first.
And who would have ever guessed that it would have been Apple Computer would have owned the digital music space the way that they have now?
Well, obviously, the record companies didn't see it.
No, of course not. I don't think anybody saw that.
I really, if you go back to Apple, I don't know if Apple even knew that they were going to be this dominant. I didn't think so.
No, but I don't think actually they ever set out to be dominant. I think they set out to sell hardware, which was iPods, and they were smart enough to realize that the way to sell a hardware was to provide people with content and make it easy and simple and painless and completely transparent to the user to get that content on and off the device.
And Apple was the first.
Keep that unit pricing. Keep that same price for everything.
Yeah,
but here's the thing. Apple has been the only company so far, and I say so far because this could change, to offer an end-to-end solution. They offer the ability to buy the hardware that the music's going to play on. They give you the ability to buy the music that's going to play on that hardware, and they give you the ability to take that hardware from cyberspace and put it on this physical device and put your earphones on and listen to it. And you can do all of that within seconds. If you find a song on iTunes, you click buy. It's on your computer within 10 seconds, a quick sync to your iPod, and you're listening to it 10 seconds later. I mean, who else offers that. You could say Microsoft with Zune, but that hasn't taken off. Why? Because the solution, the Zune, pales in comparison to what Apple's doing.
People forget that it's a whole ecosystem. It's just not one hardware device or one piece of software. It's everything.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And that kind of goes back to what I was asking about last week, Lee and David, that why isn't there an app store for applications on the Mac? And one of the reasons that you said, Lee, I think it was Lee, because of broadband speeds, how big software is, and it take a while to download it and all. Robert Hazelrig actually sent us some feedback. It broke up a little bit while he was talking, so I'm not going to play it on the show. Mm-hmm. But he actually agreed with what I had said. He thinks that because a lot of people now are buying all their software online, a lot of people are buying stuff from Adobe and downloading it, that's really not a barrier anymore. More people are on broadband now than ever before, and that's only going to get bigger. So why don't we have a place that you can go to buy software online, other than individual websites?
Right, from multiple companies.
Multiple companies. Something just like iTunes or the App Store on the iPhone, but it's simply an application, and not just a website, because I think you really limit yourself with the website, but an application that you launch, and it's a storefront, iTunes.
I'll tell you one thing related to that. I could argue that you do have something like that, and it's called Amazon. But the thing is...
Not for digital.
No, it's not for digital. And I think that one of the reasons for digital is if you're dropping more than $40, $50 for a program, I think people like to have something physical.
I think that's the thing. I don't think so anymore, David. I really don't. I think more people nowadays, especially nowadays, where their pictures are digital, their music is digital, everything is on the computer, I don't think people have this comfort level anymore that says I have to have this a physical disc.
Well, I disagree, and I'm talking about my own personal experience now. If I'm spending $100 on a program, I would quite happily, and I have done this, download a copy so I can use it straight away. But I would like to have a physical copy as well, because you know why? Because I know that if I have just a file on my computer, I'll lose it.
Can't you always burn your own disc? Can't you put it on an external hard drive?
But
you're trusting your pictures, which, let's be honest, in the long run are much more valuable than any software you're going to buy now.
I think most people don't back those up either.
I agree with you, unfortunately. You
know, and I
think more people, but let's also be honest, most of the software that's bought today costs a lot less than $100.
Yes, it does.
Most software that people buy are, you know, games are generally $50 and less, much less. Most of the applications they buy are $25, $30 games. But here's the problem. If you're a small developer, how do you compete when you don't have a physical product? You're not going to get onto Amazon because you don't have a physical product. There's no box that Amazon's going to ship and send to somebody. So you're not going to get into Amazon.
So they all
unless Apple showcases you on their website, you just got to, you know, hopefully a couple sites like My Mac Magazine, MyMac.com will review it.
Yeah.
And that will help get the word out, because most of these smaller developers don't have an ad budget. Maybe they'll get lucky and they'll get approached by, you know, one of these companies like Mac Heist, and they'll get part of that, and maybe they'll get a little bit of, you know, eyeballs that way.
And some of them.
How about this? There are two companies I can think of off the top of my head that do sell software this way, and I'll tell you who they are: Freeverse and Ambrosia Software. They take some of these smaller apps made by independent developers. They advertise them on their websites. You can download them. They keep track of your software key, so if you lose it for any reason, you can contact them and get another copy.
But you're still really, really limited by the amount of products that they're selling. And again, you're going to a website. I'm thinking that if this was an application that's sitting in your dock that a company is maintaining, and that when you launch it, it's just like iTunes. You know, you see listings for productivity, you see listings for games, you see whatever. And on the main page, it rotates every day. There's different programs featured.
Are you sure you want to talk about this and not kind of get with somebody and develop?
Well, if I had the money, I would develop something like this, because I think the smaller developers out there, of which there are thousands, and which there are going to be even more, with the with the way that the Apple is going right now selling Macs, more and more people are buying Macs. So I think that the smaller developers are only going to increase. You're going to see a lot less huge developers like Adobe and Microsoft, but you're going to see a lot more smaller developers who can really compete with those big companies with very streamlined, focused products that does really good job in image editing, that everybody doesn't need layers and Photoshop and all that. Just something very basic, well, more than basic, but just not Photoshop caliber that most people could use easily. There's already a lot of applications like that out there. Why isn't there one place that we can go to find these applications, to download a trial? If you like it, you click buy. The application itself remembers all the software that you've downloaded as well as your serial numbers. If you switch Macs, all you have to do is download that one piece of software again, sign into it just like you would iTunes. It remembers all the software you've ever downloaded. You can download it again. It offers discounts. It watches what you've already bought and says, hey, there's a new version. You can get it for, you know, $3.99.
I think smaller developers, relatively small price and get a multi-user license.
Exactly. I think smaller developers would rush to something like this if you gave them the same deal that they're getting with the App Store, 70%.
Well, maybe this will be the start of something big.
Hey, Tim, I think you're onto something. I think just let Apple, you know, get the business model to work on the App Store, and then I think this could actually take off.
But I don't think that Apple's interested in selling software to Mac users like this.
No,
I don't think it would necessarily have to be Apple. I would think that it would have to probably be a big company already, AOL, that could take something like this idea,
and
really run with it. And I'd be happy to be a product manager for that lead, by the way.
And it actually wouldn't even have to be limited to just the Mac. There's no reason why
it's just bits. I would start with the Mac simply because it would be easier to get a lot of traction really quickly on just Mac. I think that's the key.
Yeah.
Because Mac users are more likely to purchase, you know, single utility type programs like this.
Well, PC users are too, but here's the problem with the PC market is that you're going to have to work real closely with a lot of the security companies as well.
Right, there's a lot of...
Because you're talking about an application that downloads executables, and you're going to run into a lot of problems. I would focus on the Macintosh probably for the first at least year and really get it a robust system. Get it popularized, and then rolling out for the PC market as well. But I would concentrate on the Mac market at first.
Boy, this show has certainly gone in a different direction.
It has, but I think this is an important direction because, you know, as great as the internet is, it's a pain in the butt to find what I'm looking for. If there was one place I can go to look at applications and to try them and possibly buy them right there, I would totally use it. If it had enough product to make it worth my while. It can't start out with like 30 developers with, you know, 60 products and that's it. Uh-huh. I mean, it really has to start out with hundreds of software titles. It has to be very democratic in that, you know, if Ambrosia Software, which has great software, decides to send me $1,000 to keep their product on the front page for a year, that's not democratic. You can't let the developers basically buy their way into the system and get all the attention. It has to be democratic in that everybody, or you know, a good majority of them, are going to make the front page. They're going to have.
What you basically do is every time you go to the front page, there's a mix of different programs depending on maybe what you've purchased before that's going to show up.
Oh, absolutely. You can definitely do a, if you like this, then you might like this. You know, you bought three programs from this developer. Did you know that they are also making, you know, the sound editing program as well? But I think that the Mac software developers are mature enough and sophisticated enough to be able to populate such a store very easily. And I think as an end user, and this goes to the point that David Cohn was talking about, when you spend so much money on a piece of software, you know, you're going to worry about losing the software. You're going to worry about losing your serial number. Well, this application, the back end, will take care of all that for you. So, David, if you did lose the copy of, Skype, if you had to pay for Skype, the application remembers, because when you sign on to that, it knows that you already paid for this. Now, of course, you're going to have some kind of security in that. You can't go to multiple. You can't have, you know, 10 Macs and have the same account on each Mac. But generally, I think this is a concept that would work very, very well. I'm amazed that no one's done it. It would not be an easy process to get all the developers lined up, but I think if you got enough of them lined up, the rest of them would fall into line. Yep. Well, if just give them the same deal that they're getting on the iPhone. They get 70%. They don't have to worry about credit card transactions. They don't have to worry about bandwidth. They don't have to worry about any of that stuff.
They don't have to worry about packaging. They don't have to worry about disks.
Or advertising. They don't have to worry about any of that stuff. They create great applications. They submit it to the store. Once it's passed some kind of an internal, this isn't, you know, virus laden or anything like that.
Yep.
But see, and the reason that you have to get a big company to back this, like I said, AOL, and I say that because Lee's sitting here, because you have to have the infrastructure in place to be able to support that. And someone like me that came up with the idea, number one, I couldn't write a store, the software to support that myself. But I would know where to take it, so I would make a great product manager.
You can host it on your G5 too.
Yes, absolutely right.
You know, it's funny.
So you need a big company for the infrastructure that they bring to the table.
Yeah, and we're actually making an argument that I remember. If you remember Triumph of the Nerds from PBS,
absolutely.
Yeah, Larry Ellis in 1996 said, "I don't understand why people take bits, burn it onto a piece of plastic, put it into a cardboard box, and put it on a shelf at a store, and then have people drive and waste gas to get bits." And that was 12 years ago. It's just amazing that we haven't seen Amazon-type store for downloads.
That's what Amazon could do this very easily, let's be honest. If Amazon set their mind to selling software like this, they'd probably triple their sales. I think there's a huge market for this, especially with a growing Macintosh market. I think somebody could step into this and just make a killing.
Yeah.
I really, really do. And I think the developers out there deserve it.
I think you're right when you say that it would have to be, or it would work best as a separate app, similar to like the App Store or iTunes that's on your desktop.
It can't be just a website. I don't like the concept of it being a website. I don't think you have the flexibility with a website. Then again, with some of the Web 2.0 software titles that you see, maybe it would work that way. But it would have to be something that even the most basic Mac user
could easily use.
Your aunt who's 72 years old could easily use. You know, she doesn't have to remember this complex serial number to activate the software. The software does it automatically for her.
Right.
You know, copy this.
Right. Based on her username and password.
Exactly. You know, she signs up to this one time, enters a PayPal account or a credit card, and she's ready to go. I mean, if you use PayPal, you can even, here's another idea, you could actually sell prepaid cards or gift certificates. So I could send you, Guy, a $100 gift certificate to the Mac App Store.
Well, thank you.
And then all of a sudden, your Mac App Store says that you've got $100 worth of software you could buy. Tell me you wouldn't use that.
In a heartbeat.
I think this is something that the smaller developers in the Mac community, and the PC as well, but I know the Mac community, so I'm going to stick with the Mac right now. I think this is something that they could really, really use, and I think it would be a benefit for the developers. I think it would be a benefit for whoever ran a store like this. I think it would just be a money grab for them. And, of course, the developers, they're going to make 10 times more money than they're doing right now. And more importantly, for the end user would really find a lot of software that they're completely not exposed to right now. And let's be honest, if it's priced accordingly, it's going to sell. Something that goes for shareware for right now for, say, $30, and not a lot of people are buying it. They're lucky if they get, 500 copies a month sold. In a store like this, they could lower their price to $4.99 and make 10 times the amount of money because they're getting so many more customers. Does anybody disagree with that?
No.
So that's the idea. Let's see if somebody runs with it. I'd be willing to talk to anybody about running an organization like this. So that's our show this week. We'll be back next week, and then we got some news for next week about what we're doing with the show, and looks like our times are going to change, but we'll talk about that next week. Lee, thank you very much for being on.
Thanks a lot.
David Cohen, again, we appreciate you.
Always a pleasure.
And talk to you later, Guy.
Oh, it's been great.
Thanks for downloading the MyMac.com podcast. You can subscribe to this podcast at our RSS feed at MyMac.com or by visiting the iTunes Music Store's podcast section. Please send all feedback to MyMacPodcast@gmail.com. And thanks for listening to the MyMac.com podcast.